is an unrehearsed interview with William W. Marshall, class of 1957, by Glenn Tall, archivist of Georgetown College. The interview took place in the Kentucky Department for Libraries and Archives in Frankfort, Kentucky on June 13, 2002. It is funded in part by a grant from the Kentucky Oral History Commission. This is the first of two tapes. And from the point of how did you get to Georgetown?
I graduated from Frankfort High School in 1949 and attended Eastern Kentucky University on a football scholarship. But I was not mature enough yet really to have started college. And that year at Eastern was a total waste in terms of academics. I attended only enough classes to be counted as still a student, but I can jokingly say it now, but the only transferable credits in that year was ROTC, and Georgetown College did not even have that. So
I
basically began Georgetown
from scratch.
Because of that disappointing year, my father said that he simply couldn't justify supporting me to the extent that he did to go to college. So he advised me to get a job, and he made an arrangement with the Bell Telephone Company. He had a number of connections there. And in those days, and I got the job, in those days with Bell Telephone, you started at the ground level, everybody. And so you start as a lineman, L-I-N-E-M-A-N. And the linemen generally have been just the men. Women don't do that kind of work. Essentially climbing the telephone poles, stringing wire up over the cross arms, and putting up cross arms, sometimes replacing the pole itself. I'm spending a little time on this because this was a major turning point about whether or not I would go back to college. I was getting good at going up the poles. There was only one person on the team that could beat me. There were about 10 people. I finally got to be next to the best. The best happened to be I would call him the gunny sergeant of the group. And he was good. He was also a very strong man. So one day I was showing off and trying to get down the pole like a good climber can when he wants to. Essentially it means jumping out from the pole even though you still have your strap on and letting yourself fall maybe 8 or 10 feet before you stick your hooks in the pole. Well, I did that and I missed. And consequently, I had to hug that pole like a bear once my feet slipped out there in order to keep me from falling all the way down the pole. I had to catch myself. And in the process, I got a number of big splinters in my arms and body, but one really large one in my left arm, which went in between the tendons and about the size of a pencil, went in very deep. They took me, of course, to the emergency. They didn't have emergency like we do now, but to a doctor's office, and he removed it. This was toward the end of summer, and college was not more than a couple of weeks, 3 weeks away.
What year was this?
This would have been 1950, the summer of 1950. And lying on that table, I seriously said, do I really want to do this for the rest of my life? And I concluded I didn't. I also realized I would be giving up football. I really knew very little about Georgetown College other than the 1945 Frankfort High School football team was the state championship was the state, were the state champions in 1945. And when those seniors graduated, Georgetown College called the coach of Frankfort, whose name was Red Herndon, and several of the players, particularly the quarterback and several of the backs, went to Georgetown. And so as a football fan, and even on the JVs at that time, I would have been a freshman. I was impressed by that. And that's really the only impression I had of Georgetown. Uh-huh. And because of that, that day on the table, I began to think, what can I do? And I decided to literally hitchhike. I didn't have to work for several days because of the wound. I hitchhiked over to Georgetown and looked around to find the football field, which I didn't even know where it was in those days.
Was it hard to find?
No. I asked somebody and they told me where it was. And anyway, the guys were back in the early fall season in prep for the opening game. And I just walked up to the coach and I asked him if I could try out for the team. Mm-hmm. And he said, yes. And I said, well, I can't do it today, but I will come back. And he said, that's fine. He didn't have any idea who I was or what my abilities were.
So you didn't know him at Frankfort?
It was a new coach by then.
Okay.
Herndon didn't stay long.
Okay.
His name was Hewlett. Andy Hewlett was the first coach I had at Georgetown. I had four because they had such a turnover.
Uh-huh.
But, and of course, in fact, I don't think any of the Frankfort High men who went to Georgetown ever graduated from Georgetown. I think they just played a couple of years. And maybe Red Herndon was called, got a job somewhere else. I don't really know what happened to him.
Okay.
But anyway, several days later, I don't know exactly how many days it was, I went up there, I think on a Wednesday or Thursday, and went back up on a Monday after I had talked to the coach.
Mm-hmm.
And my arm essentially had been sewn up, and not anything, I hadn't cut any big vessels or anything, just sore and still needed healing, so we wrapped that, and I went out for the team.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, Georgetown would take anybody that was warm-blooded. Didn't have to be a great player. But that is the beginning. And that's how I went to Georgetown. There were no religious connections at all.
Mm-hmm.
No one suggested I go to Georgetown who was a Baptist or somebody else. This was strictly expression of what was going on within me about football.
Mm-hmm.
So it was that drew me there.
So your father, what was his occupation?
My father was a rural mail carrier from which he retired.
Okay. And you said he was a Baptist?
Yes, they were members, all of the family at that time were members of First Baptist Church of Frankfort.
Okay.
I was baptized at 10, but as you'll hear later and probably remember in my earlier conversation, as time went on, I realized it was a child's decision that to me was not authentic.
You went into some detail about becoming a Christian the last time.
Mm-hmm.
You went to California.
Yes.
Then there was a time, so you went to Georgetown and you stayed for a short time.
For 3 years.
For 3 years, okay.
Think of it in terms of it took me 6 years, not counting the Marine Corps, to graduate, to get my college degree.
Okay.
It took me actually 5 years at Georgetown.
So you spent actually 5 years at Georgetown.
50-51, 51-52, 52-53.
Okay.
Then the Marine Corps, 53-54, 54-55.
Okay.
Back to Georgetown in 55. 55-56, 56-57. Graduated
in 57. Okay. Was football the most important part of your life at Georgetown?
It certainly was the first 2 years at Georgetown.
Mm-hmm.
And I had become, by then, I was a starter. And so I got to play a lot of ball. And so it was very enjoyable to me. My attachment to Georgetown, in terms of a personal way, that might be related to the spiritual side of my life, were the friends I made, some on the football team and others not on the football team, who were practicing Christians, who were, especially the football players, who were able to be a good athlete and at the same time reflect Christian morality. I was impressed by that, even though it didn't really change my life. I still, as we say at Georgetown, I went out the road a lot with the guys. There were some vets there that I fell in with before I was a vet.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, did a lot of drinking and still not a serious student academically. Passed. In that third year, however, 52-53, I had begun to do some writing. And I was actually when Cranville, then she's the daughter of Dr. Cranville, who taught at the college.
Okay.
She's going to Curry. She was in Sigma Tau Delta, which is an honorary English fraternity.
Mm-hmm.
And because of a couple of poems I wrote, a couple of them were published in the Georgetonian, I began to feel not only some giftedness in that area,
mm-hmm.
because I was, as I look back, I was a very contemplative kind of individual. Did a lot of walking, sitting and listening to nature.
Mm-hmm.
We lived by the river. I often spent time in the river bank just sitting. So that part of me, it didn't really begin to express itself in some creative way until Georgetown College with Dr. Coleman Arnold was one of the prime movers. Especially became impressed with the Romantic period of English literature. And I would say that, along with the continued pleasure of football and the meeting of some Christian friends, some of whom are our friends today,
mm-hmm.
Enabled me to leave the campus when I did in 53 with a strong sense of well-being.
Mm-hmm.
In that college. I knew everybody, they knew me. I had a nickname by then that was given to me by the name of Bull Moose, and a lot of people today who don't know about my career but who remember me in college would remember me as Bull Moose. Some people still do that. So there was an affection about, there was an affection that I began to have for Georgetown College, that while it didn't culminate in a Christian experience or dedication.
Mm-hmm.
When the time came that I left the Marine Corps, served my time and got out, I had no other desire,
mm-hmm.
none, than to go back to Georgetown. Other than say hello to my family and spend a couple of days there, because it was just before fall.
Oh.
See, when I left college, and partly the reason I left college was they discontinued football.
Oh.
So that the 53 football season, which is in the fall, would not have had a team.
Mm-hmm.
So that, I'm sure, shaped that. I don't know how far you want me to go into this. I left.
No, go into it. Just,
well,
if you feel like going into it, yeah.
This wanderlust and this unsettledness certainly continued in 53 because I through my grandfather's relationship to, actually through my grandmother's relationship to a sister of hers who was married and lived in Santa Maria, California, I decided I wanted just to go out there and work.
Uh-huh.
And my family, of course, by that time, I was what, 21 really, didn't stop me from doing that. So I spent about 2 months in Santa Maria living with my, she would have been a great aunt, and her husband. And I worked in a potato bagging company, 50-pound bags of potatoes. And that's what I did for an income, and found that there was a semi-pro football team there,
Ooh.
Santa Maria Redskins. and I played for them. It was, I became the punter for the team and played. I was too small to be tackled. These guys were, you know, semi-pro big guys, but I could punt well.
They were still even large back then, huh?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, you know, 240 was large then,
uh-huh.
and certainly my best weight was 205. But anyway, that's what I was doing, and then my father sent the notice I had gotten in the mail to be drafted.
Oh.
Because I dropped out of school.
Oh, okay. This is when the Korean conflict was going on.
That's right. So I had to report, of course, report in Kentucky
mm-hmm.
to the draft office, draft board. I still don't, you know, I don't know exactly why, but I'm attributing my decision rather than to go into the Army, into which I would have been drafted. I don't know whether it's because I didn't want to, I can remember a few things like this, but these are pieces of it. I didn't want to go to Fort Knox. It was not far from home. It didn't seem romantic to me.
Yeah.
I had an uncle, who was still living at the time, who had been a Marine in World War II.
Uh-huh.
And I was always impressed with him. My mother said I even looked more like him than anyone in our family. And he was I had maybe some admiration for him.
Mm-hmm.
And then my cousin, who was my best friend for a number of years, he was a year ahead of me in high school. And he was killed in the Korean War.
Okay.
And I don't know, a sense of obligation. You don't know what goes on in a young man's mind. And so I joined the Marines.
So you had the opportunity to join any branch of the service you wanted to, despite the fact that you got a draft notice?
I could have joined any branch but the Coast Guard.
Okay.
And particularly they were looking for Marines, and they would have probably made an exception even if that weren't true.
Okay.
So
that sort of explains when my dad got his draft notice after graduating from Mars Hill, that he joined. He joined the Army, but he still joined rather than being just drafted.
Yeah. Well, that's essentially what happens.
Yeah.
Once you choose the branch of service that if you're entitled to,
okay,
to go there. So anyway, I became a Marine. Trained in South Carolina, all these details, I'm not sure. Parris Island.
Right.
The thing I'd like to say about the Marine Corps, two things. One is, it was in the Marine Corps that I began to be a man.
Okay.
To take responsibility, to be aware of teamship. I wouldn't have called it that or anything like that. But the obligation you have to others to save your life, and the requirements that all military people have, make your own bed, shine your own shoes, all of that, I don't mind this going into the thing, into the tape, but I was still pretty much a rebel. And I had several fights, mainly because I didn't do what the sergeant wanted us to do.
Uh-huh.
So I was still pretty feisty. I think having those fights, though, helped me to grow up more. Mm-hmm. It got stuff out of me and helped me realize what I'm doing. The war.
Did you ever have that problem with your football coach?
There's a story to tell before. Back in this period, I was at Georgetown the first time. We had lost a game to Chattanooga, Tennessee. We got slaughtered. And the coach didn't think, even though we were slaughtered and outmanned, I mean, there were a couple of little All-Americans on their team, big guys, and we were a small team. He was still kind of taking it out on us a little bit, didn't think we'd been putting out as much. Even I think he felt we had let down once we realized how good they were and how they were going to walk all over us.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, he was giving us a hard time on Monday. Normally that was a no pads day and things like that. And I remember, coach was George Claiborne, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
Jerry Claiborne's brother.
Oh, is that right?
Yes. His older brother. And he was making the team run when, this was after we had done all the head knocking and stuff like that. He was making us do 10-yard wind sprints.
Mm-hmm.
Get out on the line, run as fast as you can for 10 yards and stop. And he continued to do that. And I don't know whether I really wasn't putting out or what, but he said, Moose, if you don't put out 10 laps around the field. And he singled me out. And I thought I was putting out when I ran that 10. He said, okay, Moose, 10 laps. And I got really mad.
Mm-hmm.
And I said some words to the coach I shouldn't have said, and I walked off the field and hung up my uniform. I was going to punish him. I'm sure that's what I was thinking I was going to do by quitting the team. And
yeah.
I did.
Yeah.
And those were, oh gosh, that was a very, very low time in my life. Because here was this sport I loved so much and was so much a part of me. After about 24 hours, after I had quit, I realized what I had done.
Yeah.
I didn't want to tell my father. To make the story short, I mean, the next game was against Union University now. We should have really walked all over them. We didn't have many substitutes,
mm-hmm.
and I was a good defensive player. And they beat us 7-6. And I always got the blame for that. I was sitting up in the stands, and I really was cheering for our team.
Yeah.
But I had the terrible, terrible, terrible feeling. It's probably the most depressing time I've ever had in my life. To make it short, unaware of this, a couple of guys on the team, one of them had been my roommate at the KA house, his name was Bill Sparks, they went to the coach. Well, let me back up. I went to the coach about 2 days after I had quit. And he was not married, lived over in a shotgun house there just behind Hinton Field.
Okay.
And I don't think that house is there anymore.
Probably not.
But he was there, and I knocked on the door. He said, come in, Moose. And I said, I'm really sorry, I apologize, everything I knew how to do.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm sorry, Moose. I can't do that, not after what you do in front of the team. And so I really kind of thought it was over. Really, I did. But I learned that a couple of the football guys had gone to the coach and said, Coach, we really would like for you, you know, to consider letting Moose come back. I learned this. You know, I wasn't present. It was what they call a skull session.
Uh-huh.
You know, you're not in the classroom talking about what your plays are and working on that. And so anyway, the coach had been talked to by a couple of these guys, and what he apparently worked out in terms of his own ability to keep his integrity about this, he said, all right, if the team will vote, we'll have a vote. If the team wants him back, we'll take him.
Mm-hmm.
It's up to the team. They had the vote, and there were a number that voted against me.
Right.
They really didn't like what I did. Anyway, they voted for me to come back, and I have a hard time telling this.
Was this near the end of the last year before you went into the Marines or went out to California?
Yes. Anyway, when I went down, they then called Cage to pick up my uniform again. It was still on, hung them on hooks and turned them in.
Yeah.
It was still there, and I got it back. And walking into that dressing room that day, you get to be an old man, you can't tell the stories as easily as you used to.
Yeah.
Anyway, a number of them came up to me and said, welcome back, Moose. And that may have been most humiliating experience I've ever had in my life.
Mm.
And it was the most vivid gift of forgiveness that I've ever known, even since then.
Huh.
So I think I played, you know, I went back on the team, I guess, for the next game. I really don't remember. I could easily see, because if I looked at the schedule, I could see where we played Chattanooga and then Union, and then I don't remember how many more games there were, but I came back and played. And they announced the season was going to be over. George Claiborne left, became the superintendent of Davis County High School.
Huh.
And he and I remained good friends for years.
Uh-huh. Why did Georgetown, do you know why Georgetown discontinued football?
My understanding, it was a financial factor.
Uh-huh.
And of course, I had no concept of administration or what was going on. There was no discussion among the students.
Uh-huh.
But my understanding was that they simply couldn't afford to do it.
Edelman had assumed the presidency by that time.
Yes, he had He was not the president when I left in 53, as I recall. It was still Sam Hill.
Okay.
And then I think Edelman came. He was certainly there when I came back.
Right.
So I don't know which of those 2 years, whether it was 52 or 53, that he became president.
So this must, I'm trying to think back in my, this what little knowledge I know of athletics at Georgetown. This must be the first or second time they discontinued football since football has been at Georgetown.
You know, that could have been also what happened to that 45 group. I don't know. They had football in 48.
Dr. 49. Mills tried to discontinue it for a while, mm-hmm. here in the early 70s, but the trustees voted him down.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Basically for the same reasons, for financial reasons.
Well, of course, that's characteristic of big cars, big or small cars. It's a drain rather than an asset.
Unless you're a Notre Dame or one of the powerhouses, and I can't see anything but
going down with much.
Yes.
Not much.
So where did you live when you came to Georgetown?
First time?
Yeah.
First time. I lived at the KA house the first year. I pledged the first year. And to be truth, you know, my mind is fuzzy whether I stayed the second of the 3 years I was at Georgetown the first time, or whether I transferred out since I didn't. Go all the way and become a KA. Either the second year I was there or the third, I lived, or 2 years, I lived at a place called Adams House, which was on Main Street. If you remember where the Lamakai House was, or the Pike House, I know you remember that.
Mm-hmm.
You turn to your left, go out Main Street, it's in the last block of Main Street on the right before you make the turn to go down to the underpass and out.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It was either the second or third house. There were about 16 or 18 guys that lived there. Had a house mother, her name was Mom Ashby. She was influential. She tried her best to help me, begin. She was a very strong Christian, but she was not pushy.
Yeah.
She always left her door open for anybody who wanted to talk up until 10 o'clock. And she took a liking to me, and we became friends.
Uh-huh.
So I actually corresponded with her during the Marine Corps. See, this part was there, too. I'm glad you asked me about where I lived, because that lady impressed me as being a really fine, or what I thought a Christian ought to be. And she liked music, and I liked music, so sometimes I'd go there and just sit with her and listen to music and we'd talk.
Uh-huh. Well, living in was housing for men really limited at that time down on campus?
Yeah. Yeah, there really only was Pauling Hall. That was the only actual dorm that there was for men. And across from that was Rooker Hall, which was huge.
Right.
And that's where the girls were, plus the dining area. The dining room.
Yeah.
But that was it. The girls also, sororities had houses, and they didn't have the complex they have now.
Uh-huh. What was it like living in the KA house?
Well, for me, it was fun. but I lived up on the top floor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember having many impressions. It was because I was not a serious student. And some of the guys there were, and they tended to pair guys with their interests or whatever, and I was paired with a football player. And I know that I wasn't really drawn to be, I knew that I wasn't really drawn to be a part of the fraternity, even though I was a pledge. And I had a lot of football players and friends who were pie caps.
Mm-hmm.
And I had some, I was ambivalent about fraternities.
In general,
but not because I had any religious, I wouldn't have judged them. I was a party boy, still.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so,
it's been said, when Ken Finley was there, that there was a lot of antagonism toward fraternities from the ministerial students.
Yeah. Yeah, there was, I wasn't part of that ministerial group. I don't remember them being like people said they were, Holy Joes and all of that. I don't really remember that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't feel that way. There certainly were a lot more young men and women, though they weren't thinking of pastoral ministry. There were a lot more men in planning for the ministry. And a good many of my friends there became pastors and or missionaries.
Mm-hmm.
A bunch of that group that I was with became missionaries.
Uh-huh.
So there was a climate there. There are a lot of reasons for that, I think.
Yeah. So did you live in the Adams House for the rest of...
Yes, until I went to the Marine Corps.
Until you went to the Marine
Corps. Mm-hmm.
And that was basically an independent men's living quarters. It didn't belong to a club or an organization
right.
or anything like that.
Right. But they didn't call them independents. They didn't have that independent fraternity or sorority.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they call it now. They have a name for it. They've given it Greek letters, but basically it's into those who don't want to be a Greek.
I'm not aware of that.
Okay, well, that's what this was. There was a time when they were independents, and the word on the campus would have been, he's a Greek, he's a KA, she's an independent. So that's the terminology that I remember.
Was there a certain camaraderie among the Adams House residents?
Yeah, it
similar to the Greeks, maybe, or
yeah, because there were three of us in one room, and all three of us played on the football team. So certainly in the rooms assigned, there was camaraderie, and certainly we knew each other's names.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't remember having Adams House meetings unless there was, we didn't have monthly meetings like a fraternity would or sponsor things other than a float in the parade.
Did y'all have teams in intramural sports?
Actually, I'm vague on that. I played intramural basketball and I don't remember whether it was independent, what they call an independent team, or whether we were Adams House. I can't really remember. But the Greeks, of course, did have individual Greek teams.
Did y'all have social occasions?
No.
Okay. So what was the social life like? What kind of things did you do in the
George Center?
Yeah.
Obviously very different from today. there were very few, proportionately, there were very few students who had a car. Consequently, Lexington and all the traveling, there were more on-campus people than there were commuters. And that's why we got to, I think that's why we got to know people on campus easier. The social life would have been, of course, again, the Greeks had their social lives, formals and all of that, and there was interchange there.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, they had annual Christmas occasions. They had campus sing, where groups of the sorority or fraternity sang. There was stunt night, where you know, put on something silly or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But social, you know, there were no dances. Other than the and of course, not everybody was so crazy about football, but the football and basketball were a draw to students, and many of them did stay because they didn't have any place to go and no way to get there.
Mm-hmm.
There were very few options,
mm-hmm,
of social activity when we were there. Whereas today, you know, all kinds of extracurricular. It's a huge extracurricular
Well, it's kind of ironic. Today, students have the mobility to go out off campus and do things. So, and this was sort of a problem when I went to school, but so the student life services will do all these activities to keep them interested in staying on campus. In your day, you had the problem of no cars, and people were basically trapped on campus, and there wasn't that much thought given to extracurricular activities.
That's true.
Aside from the literary the debates, or the, what other club that you could belong to? I mean,
there were a number of clubs. Yeah.
Yeah, did you belong to any of the clubs?
Sigma Tau Delta was an honorary writers fraternity. When I came back in 55 and 56, I was the editor of the Joyce Tournament. Continued doing the writing.
Mm-hmm.
Played one more year of football, then I was no longer eligible.
Mm-hmm.
Sang in the choir early, the men's corral, I mean the corral, you know, all those things people could do. You got to remember that I don't have the exact enrollment in my mind, except chapel was required,
mm-hmm,
and they took roll.
Mm-hmm.
You can miss so many, that's it. And the chapel was always, very rarely was it not something religious. And there was planning, and events on campus that were primarily religious, such as focus weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I can remember being impressed by these professionals, Howard Butt, George Schweitzer, just a number of very bright, congenial people.
Mm-hmm.
Kearney Keegan was a great pianist. He'd come in and do the piano stuff. I mean, that was good for us in those days. Now, you know, you got to have river dance to get people to come. So anyway.
Well, and that was changing. So
I was never bored.
Yeah.
On campus.
Yeah.
And I went to church occasionally.
Well, what did you all do since you didn't have? There wasn't a college sponsored social activities. What did you do just with your friends or whatever for extracurricular activities or recreation?
The first time around, before I came back from the Marine Corps, at which time I would have a car then,
mm-hmm,
basically, I don't know that we did anything socially other than what was planned by the college. And if we were invited by, say, a Sigma girl to go to one of their formals, we did. I mean, so there was interchange. Not everybody, but during when the Greeks would do their things, often their partner would be either somebody from home or somebody on campus who wasn't a Greek.
Uh-huh. So
there was that kind of interchange. I just can't think. I can't think of any real. I mean, we, you know, basically sat around and talked.
Because you didn't have television.
No.
You didn't have. Did you have radio that you listened to?
Yeah, Moon River was very popular in those days. Came on at either 10 or 11. It was music to go to sleep by out of Louisville. I always listened to that down low.
Uh-huh.
And that was a popular station.
So, where did you eat? I mean, what were they eating? Did you eat at Adam's house or did you eat at Rucker?
We didn't eat at Adam's house. You could cook, I mean, you could have light things like you could eat a sandwich or soft drink or something. Mostly I ate at Rooker, which is where the general cafeteria was. There was another place, and I think one or two pieces of the foundation still exist between the chapel and Giddings. There was what we call the Quonset Hut. We called it the Hut. And there you could get sandwiches and Cokes and French fries. And that was also where the mail was distributed in those days. So that was it. And then there was Fava's downtown, which still exists. And a lot of us, that was weekend, that was a big deal. And so you go down there for Sunday lunch. The White Star was there then, and that was another place where we went for hamburgers or whatever. Campus Cottage was there. Have you ever heard of Campus Cottage? You walk down directly in front of the new Arts Center, going toward town. Next block, there's it's right across the street from the parking lot of First Baptist Church.
I know what you're talking about.
It's probably a 1800s building. It's one story.
It's a long building.
Yeah.
Right now it has yellow doors on it.
Yeah. And I worked there washing dishes a couple of months.
Now I understood students operated that.
No, he used them for, they may have at some time, but the years I was there, his name was Soup Bean. We called him Soup Bean. I can't think of his last name. He was an adult.
But he was an independent businessman.
Yes, he owned it.
That wasn't employed by the college, and that wasn't a college thing. No. It was just a business that was operating.
I'm sure most of his clientele were students.
Yeah.
Wish I could think of his last name. Many people my age would know him. But that was the other place that was close. Nothing else. Had to walk all the way down the town, which is not far.
No.
And the people that had cars, as I said, they went to Lexington. There was one big movie house over there then on Main Street. A place called the Green Dome out Lexington Road on 27 going toward Lexington on past, and just before you get to the overpass. The structure stayed a long time. I think it's gone now. But that was the place where the sororities and fraternities rented for the dances. And it was basically a dance hall, a nice thing. And people would go there. Of course, too far to walk, so you had a car.
Yeah. So did you go with groups when you went to eat, or?
Two or three. Nobody ate alone.
What were the hours for eating at Rucker?
They would have been probably, I'm guessing, they weren't unusual hours, but they strictly were for the meal. They weren't 24 hours.
Right.
I don't even remember whether they served breakfast there or not. I think they did. But, it, you know, think of it as 11 to 1 or something mm-hmm. like that for the meals and 5 to 7 for dinners. And I think, I'm not sure they were even open on Sundays. If they were, I think they only had one meal.
Mm-hmm.
Probably lunch.
Hmm.
So social life, I guess you'd say it thrust some people together more closely in smaller groups, other than the Greeks. And the size of the student body made it possible for anyone who wasn't a recluse to really get to know names. I probably knew everybody.
Mm-hmm.
By 1953, I probably knew everybody on campus.
What were you at? Had you had any sense of what direction you wanted to go as far as a vocation? It sounds like if you didn't in your first period of Georgetown. So did you have any idea what you wanted to major in, or you were just filling yourself out as far as?
That's where it would have been my third year. Is where English and English literature and writing
mm-hmm.
came into an awareness, and why I basically majored when I came back in literature, and I kept a minor in phys ed. I didn't really know what I wanted to be. You know, I was with the other guys who wanted to be a coach. I was an athlete. I was going to be prepared to do that. I didn't have any sense of call to it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me if you want to follow up on this, but there's an aside here that's important to me,
okay.
but has nothing whatever to do with Georgetown. My hometown is Frankfort.
Right.
Born and raised here, and had a close friend who was became a graduate of Davidson and was an attorney, and maybe the county. Yeah, he certainly was either county. Attorney until his death, and he's been dead several years. But his name was Billy Brooks, and Billy and I, again, these were the drinking days.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go out and get a couple of beers together, and he was a poet type as well. And we didn't really have a close relationship until he was in law school at
mm-hmm.
UK, and. He and I spent a lot of time together making up songs.
Huh.
And one of them was good. And one of them, we actually had the band perform at one of the cotillion dances. It's called the Bachelor's Club in Frankfort. They had an annual Christmas dance, and that was a fun time.
Uh-huh.
And so he and I did the duet with the band playing our number.
Is that right? Uh-huh. You still have the manuscript for that?
No, I could come up with the tune and some of the
words.
Yeah, I'd have to reach back. But anyway, that, even though that was I guess you would say an aside, but our friendship was very strong, and I always, when we were home,
mm-hmm.
or I'd go to UK Law School, stay with him, and he was in kind of a, he'd already gotten out of fraternity, he was graduate school.
Oh, okay.
So he was Kappa Sig.
Okay.
But anyway, I stayed with him, and we would, you know, basically go out and get a couple of beers, and start harmonizing and writing. And he really had, he was bright. He
uh-huh.
really was a bright, he won honors. I think he graduated either summa or magna from Davidson. Good basketball player, starter there for a number of years. Anyway.
Uh-huh. Well, that's kind
of interesting. That friendship is the only friendship I had where, when I look back on it, where we fed each other because we had this common poetic streak.
Mm-hmm.
And the beer, I think, probably more than we even realized, loosened us up to, you know, to just emote. And I'm getting way off. But it is part.
I know.
It is part of what ultimately became the drive that brought me back to Georgetown when I got out of the Marine Corps. Because I was already a member of Sigma Tau Delta.
Okay.
And I, by that time, had begun to think of myself maybe, editor of a local paper or writer.
Who was your most memorable professor?
You stop me when I'm going too much.
Oh, that's fine.
On any subject.
Okay.
Because you're trying to bear down on Georgetown, aren't you? It's hard to. I won't order them, okay?
Right.
But there were three or four that. Four, really. That the first one was Brad Jones, who was the athletic director. And I really admired that man. And he took a liking to the boys. They never had a child. You know, we've always wanted one. And never could do that. And I guess the affection of the man. Sometimes I had a job in the gym where, that last year, because that's how I paid my way to Georgetown, along with a very modest football scholarship. He would, if I was oversleeping, by that time I was living in Fisher House. Hey, that's where it was. K.A.'s, Adams House 1 year, Fisher House 1 year.
Okay.
And that was very close to campus. And he would come over and shake me and say, "You got to get over there." Which, well, he didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
He could have fired me or he could have done whatever. But he several times came over and got me to do my job. So his personal relationship was meaningful to me. And he taught me to do the shot put, and I won the KIAC tournament a couple of years, and it was because of him. I had never had a shot put. Didn't even know what it was, but he thought. The second one would have been George Redding, who was a Bible teacher, of course. And I really got to know him best when I came back, 57. So, and he married Alice and me at our request when we married in August of 57 after we graduated.
Okay.
He helped me to learn to begin to enjoy and like the Bible. I probably hadn't even realized what the church was. He helped me to appreciate the value of the Bible. And it was more than intellectual awareness. It was visceral. Because there are things about that still reside here. The third one would have been Dr. Coleman Arnold, but he, in his area, he'd still be number one.
Yeah.
He was such a patient man. And he could make the poets, like especially the romantics, he really, apparently, of course to me, he knew it all, and he may not have been a great student, I don't know about his background, but I know that he made the romantics come alive, and that's when I really got turned on with literature, and particularly the romantic period. And I ended up, as I said, majoring in literature. His influence, he was a chaperone, he was a faculty representative at Sigma Tau Delta, and we always met in his home. He would host it, his wife, and he had a son, Jack Arnold, who was in school with me.
Oh.
Jack is dead. I believe Jack died. There's another younger Arnold whose name he was younger, not in college, I can't think of his name. But their home was open, and he, again, there were two or three of us that he was obviously, looking back, was nurturing.
Mm-hmm.
I was one of them. I think Gwen was another.
Mm-hmm.
A woman, a girl whose name was Martha Banta then.
Martha Banta.
B-A-N-T-A. She became the editor, associate editor of the Georgetonian the year I left and graduated. And she worked for the Courier as a writer for a number of years until her divorce from Phil,
mm-hmm.
and then moved and married a man who they live in Maryland.
Mm-hmm.
I keep up with her.
Oh.
Fourth person, anyway, Coleman Arnold in that side of my life. The fourth person would have been Dorothy Melzer, M-E-L-Z-E-R. She had not been on campus early, the early years, but she had come there apparently in the gap.
Mm-hmm.
So she's in the second half.
Yes.
Of your...
Yes. She taught journalism, and she was the faculty sponsor for the Georgetonian and the yearbook.
Mm-hmm.
Both. I took journalism, I don't remember, one and two, or
mm-hmm.
I took all the journalism they offered
mm-hmm.
under her. And again, she aligned it, she helped me get to know a fellow by the name of John Sutterfield, who was then the owner and editor of the Georgetown Daily News or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And she made an arrangement for us to, that's where the Georgetonian then was printed.
Okay.
And so I spent a good bit of time every week in the shop watching the old linotypist. His name was Tiny, he weighed about 400 pounds.
Yeah.
And then taking the type, you don't need to hear all this, but it was all done with molten lead.
Yeah, and I'm familiar with it.
And so we had to do the proofs, and learned how to use the markings, you know, the editorial markings, omit, and you know, and that was kind of fun. And then after the publication, we would take it to the various houses on campus,
uh-huh.
and then there was a small number left somewhere in the general location. But she affirmed, very affirming of my writing. By that time, Gwen's husband was on campus teaching English, and he was maybe I'm not sure what his role was, but he's